21st Century Radio is sponsored by Hieronymus & Company. This is Talk Radio 680 WCBM. It's time now for award-winning 21st Century Radio. Here's your host, Dr. Bob Hieronymus.
My shoes are worn out, walking down this same highway. I don't see nothing new, but I feel a lot of change. And I get the strangest feeling as I'm heading for the light.
Welcome back to 21st Century Radio. This is Dr. Bob Hieronymus, a lowly PhD, hanging out in this part of the megaverse. Our executive producer and research assistant, Laura Cortner, our engineer, is a new person. That's right. We're getting a new person tonight, and we don't know their name yet. However, well, we'll figure that out. Now, you know, I've never been a fan of Christopher Columbus, and when I did research on Columbus and the thousands of humans he enslaved and put to death for gold, I was ashamed of everything he stood for. I just called it greed. I had many mentors who felt the same, and some who worked for the OSS and CIA who advised me to study the works of Dr. Barry Fell, Dr. Cyrus Gordon, and pay attention to Roland Gillespie, Gloria Farley, and, of course, Gunnar Thompson. Yeah, good old Gunnar Thompson. I know he's still alive. And others, and I was just happy to forget that Columbus ever existed. Tonight, our guest knows all my friends, and maybe he even knew Chris Bird and Peter Tompkins, who had a deep interest in those who came to America repeatedly, even though they didn't necessarily get their history right all the time. Well, not too many people do. However, we are going to, one of the things of which I am most proud of on 21st Century Radio is back in our first year of broadcasting in 1988, when no one else was doing this type of program anywhere else in the country, we sought out some of the best scholars and academics on the so-called unexplained and gave them probably the only radio interviews they ever did. Reading tonight's book about the multitude of discoveries that indicate many peoples traveled to Americas on a regular base reminded me of these early years of 21st Century Radio when we did interview such notables as Barry Fell and Cyrus Gordon repeatedly on these subjects, and we pulled out those old interviews to enjoy and have recorded a five-minute clip of Uncle Barry Fell telling us about the discovery of the Peterborough petroglyphs in Ontario, and we'll play that for you a little later this hour. It's a great story. Our guest tonight is Carl Lehrberger, and he studied archaeological and sacred sites in the Americas with a focus on ancient world peoples in America before Columbus, and for more than 25 years. He's probably done this many lifetimes. He has published articles in Ancient America, one of our favorite magazines. He's an avid traveler and explorer, and he lives in Talent, Oregon. And the book we're going to be talking about is The Secrets of Ancient America, Archaeoastronomy, and the Legacy of the Phoenicians, Celts, and Other Forgotten Explorers. Welcome to 21st Century Radio, Carl.
Hi, Bob, and greetings to 21st Century Radio listeners. It's just wonderful to be here.
How's your pitching arm tonight? Is it all right?
Yeah, you're doing great.
No, I'm doing all right. What about your pitching arm? Is it doing okay? You got a curveball or what?
I think I've been sitting in my desk too long and getting calluses, so I got to put the body to work.
Okay, well, it's about time we did. So we're going to put you to work tonight. Here it goes. You ready for this one?
I am.
Yeah, all right. Why did you write this book, Carl?
Well, you know, that's, of course, the beginning point, and it's kind of a segue to my own history, but, you know, I guess the short story is that the bewildering contradictions, you know, with the modern historical narrative became overwhelming. And I felt like I had been bumping up against a huge bubble that is the new history of America versus the old history of America. And that old history, you know, is kind of segued from your introduction talking about Columbus and how Columbus discovered America, and he was the first explorer, and we have a priesthood that in the book, Secrets of Ancient America, I dubbed the archaeo-priesthood, that have preserved this old history that the Native Americans and their wisdom and their culture grew up in isolation. But this old history archaeo-priesthood philosophy has been challenged by diffusionist scholars, some of the great ones that you've mentioned, like Barry Fell and Cyrus Gordon, who wrote Before Columbus, and Gunnar Thompson, who wrote A Discovery of America. And these diffusionists challenged the archaeopriest and the old narrative, and it was like I say, bewildering to me that with the evidence in apparent abundance, everyone was still talking about Columbus discovering America, and whenever it was suggested that even before the Vikings, nobody had discovered, only the Native Americans were here. And it was this really bizarre situation as I learned more and more from site work and meeting scholars and some of my mentors and teachers, that my head just became so full that I had to put it on paper. Mm-hmm. And the goal was pretty lofty, that is to change the paradigm, the old history paradigm. And clearly, at least at this stage, 1 year after the book was published, that has not happened, and maybe we'll talk about that a little later. But clearly, that's been the objective and the goal of many scholars and many researchers going back hundreds of years in the United States, trying to bring to life and decode these ancient symbols to provide an accurate history of America, which we don't have. So the point of writing the book was really to reveal what I had learned through my teachers and site work with the hope of changing the paradigm.
You have done a terrific job. Now, terrific's it's not the best word to hear because it's beyond that. We really needed this book, Carl. We really did. Because the good thing about it, many good things about it, but you tell both sides of the story. And that is what, when other people have written something about this, unfortunately, they didn't tell both sides. And that leads to problems, obviously, because those problems are going to pop up sooner or later. And that's one of the reasons why I think this book should be a bestseller. Should be in every high school and college, period. And as a matter of fact, when I'll be giving my talks at Johns Hopkins University, I'll be mentioning your book. And because most people need to read this kind of material. So congratulations. And I won't compliment you anymore, so I don't want to embarrass you. But, you've really made sure that we got this book at a time in our history of this country than we, hopefully, that the priests of all of this eventually, as usual, they'll pass on. That's how history changes. I was told that a long time ago, that's what's going to happen. When they all die, then it will eventually change.
If I could just comment on what you said about universities and colleges and high schools. Usually this subject comes up toward the end of the interview, but it's such an important part of paradigm shifting, that is education. And, one of the points that I make in the book is that there are a tremendous amount of gatekeepers that really have prevented much of the new history information, evidence of ancient explorers and cultures, and actually wisdom of these cultures, including the Native American peoples. Mm-hmm. So having to address the issue of how do we change the paradigm, it really involves education. And this is one of the biggest challenges that people who are trying to bring light to this subject encounter. Because the gatekeepers at the universities really have done an incredible job of preventing this kind of diffusionist research where, as an example, you could go out to the Four Corners area in North America in the summertime, and you'll see dozens of archaeologists and scores and scores of graduate students crisscrossing these ancient, mostly Anasazi sites, Native American sites, and important, but certainly over very heavily studied. Yet you'll find in nearby areas where there are evidence of ancient travelers from Europe or from Indus Valley that you can find in New Mexico and Arizona and throughout the Great Basin, you won't find any archaeologists or any graduate students there. They stay away from these petroglyph sites. Some of them have ancient writing in them that can be attributed to European cultures. You won't see them there. So we need a new generation of scholars, of epigraphers, those students that study ancient writing systems, archaeoastronomers that take archaeology to a new level of looking at how the stars and the planets and the position of the sun and the moon influenced ancient cultures, and new students willing to take on the old history paradigm that really has its roots in Columbus discovered America. So it's such an important point, and we're hopeful in the coming years that good universities and good colleges are going to have new history integrated into the history programs. And it's really going to have to involve not just a teacher here or a professor there suggesting that students read Barry Fell or read Gunnar Thompson or, if I be so fortunate, Secrets of Ancient America. But it really goes to designing the curriculums and getting the infrastructure in place so that we have a free dialogue that mm-hmm. goes on, that it's not controlled by one group of ideologues in the archaeological community, which is what we see today. And, you know, I'm here to suggest that we will know when the paradigm has shifted, when we see National Geographic magazine doing stories on the ancient Celtic travelers of North America, or the Smithsonian magazine taking a look at ancient European languages found in specific Native American tongues. And when we see these major institutions like Harvard and state universities that have curriculums that students and graduate students can go to some of these, quote, controversial sites, unquote, and do extensive investigations that haven't been done. The truth is that there is evidence and there are petroglyph sites that prove Europeans made it to America hundreds and thousands of years before Columbus, but these sites have not really been professionally studied. They've mostly been looked at on the surface, looked at from the point of view of the studying the petroglyphs and studying the archaeoastronomy, and in some of these sites, the languages that seem to be on the walls, the cave walls. So with this new paradigm coming and this the integrating a much more holistic approach to history that includes not only ethnology, but it includes archaeoastronomy and epigraphy and all the integrated sciences, that's really going to paint a picture for us. That's the day that we're all shooting for. And that's when we're really going to see the new paradigm and a realization of the new history of America.
We have
did not discover America.
Okay, we have about a minute here, but take a break here. Secrets of Ancient America, Archaeoastronomy and the Legacy of Phoenicians, Celts, and Other Forgotten Explorers, published by Inner Traditions, thenewhistoryofamerica.com. Go to that website. Carl's other very interesting clean energy business ventures, when sometime in the future we'll have him on talking about purevisiontechnology.com and www.purehemptech.com. Radio.com.
This is Dr. Robert Schock, author of Voices of the Rocks, and you're listening to 21st Century Radio with Dr. Bob Hieronymus, one of the most fascinating shows on the air.
Hey, hello, Dr. Schock. He's probably going to be listening to us tonight. Our guest is Carl Lehrberger, Secrets of Ancient America, Archaeoastronomy and the Legacy of the Phoenicians, the Celts and Other Forgotten Explorers, Inner Traditions. I love that title. This is an important book. If you don't have this book in your library, I suggest you get at least one of them, because if you only get one, well, no, you better get two. If you get one and you lend it out to someone, you'll never get it back. So rules and regulations of 21st Century Radio is you should always probably buy two of the good books that we recommend. Do you think that's all right, Carl?
Oh, please do.
Okay, please do.
Pass
that.
Pass it along. That's
long
the good word.
All right. Okay. Now, obviously, we all have mentors. Tell us about yours.
Well, I like to say, and it's not my quote, that you know, to see a new history of America, you have to stand on many, many shoulders. And you just have to say at the outset of an interview like this that no one person can ever discover a new history or write a history. It's really through the contributions of teachers, mentors, and the previous researchers, and in this case, generations of researchers that have led the way. And I'd like to, you know, I guess start when I talk about my mentors and teachers with Barry Fell. And like so many diffusionists, beginning in the 1970s, people read Barry Fell's, you know, book, America B.C., and they couldn't believe it. He laid out a history of America that just contradicted everything that we had been taught. And, of course, you know, it was the benefit that Dr. Fell provided all of us in terms of opening the door. But we all really had to take a step back when we saw the kind of criticism and the kind of really slander that Dr. Fell underwent, as well as nearly all diffusionist scholars. Now, one thing that on the negative side that myself and my colleagues learned is that in spite of his great work and in spite of the revelations, Dr. Fell made mistakes, and it was mistakes in his research methodology and his approaches, and he would often take drawings that people did of petroglyphs, who would send them to him in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and based on those drawings, he would, you know, using epigraphy, he would interpret the writing systems, but many times these drawings were flawed, and the characters were out of order, and he was interpreting things that weren't there. And, you know, when the critics brought this up, you know, they were right. Some of his methods were sloppy. So one of the takeaways from that is that going down this road, you got to get it right. And you just can't take other people's word for it that this is a Hebrew tablet sitting in a museum. No, you know, there's been so many fakes along the way that by passing along information that yes, that tablet is Hebrew, all of a sudden, you know, I or other researchers become part of the problem. So there was a break that occurred with Barry Fell's Epigraphy Society, and two of the scholars that broke with Barry Fell, Bill McGlone and Phil Leonard, were focused on studying Celtic ogham or Celtic writing in Colorado that had appeared on, I'd say, dozens of dozens of petroglyph sites. And these two scholars, both of them were retired when I met them, and Bill McGlone is passed away in 2001. Phil Leonard is retired and still alive. These were the real McCoy guys. These were the guys that devoted their life to going out on the field, meeting with ranchers, finding these sites, writing professional papers, giving professional presentations, being called on to testify at hearings. And, you know, I guess you'd have to say they took the brunt of the very angry response of the archaeopriesthood, who thought they were kooks. And just a quick example of what I'm talking about at a site that I highlight in the book called Anubis Cave, that is filled with Celtic writing and petroglyphs that are aligned to Celtic holidays. The archaeopriesthood claimed that McGlone and Leonard drew the petroglyphs there, chipped them out and drew them, because they were the only people capable of that kind of knowledge. And, it was such an absurd claim, but what McGlone did was he was able to show that there was some graffiti in the cave that had been done like in 1898. And he demonstrated how the graffiti went on top of these original petroglyphs to prove that it couldn't be him. But it's through the field work of people like Bill McGlone and Phil Leonard that took a scientific approach. You got to prove it to me. You can't just say that it's Celtic. You got to prove it. Mm-hmm. And you've got to be able to have a methodology that can go out to academia to show this is 100% Celtic writing in Colorado, and we can't exactly date it, but we can give it a time frame of 1,000 to 2,000 years, or whatever the case may be. So it's not just the pioneering work of Barry Fell that inspires me, because it takes more than a pioneer, but it's actually the scientific, the hard researching that goes on. That I learned from Bill McGlone and Phil Leonard, that you have to have if you're going to make the case to academia, if you're going to make the case to the National Geographic Society, that this is smoking gun evidence proof. And to deny it is to not deny the scientific method. So that's some of the inspirations and takeaways from some of my mentors over the decades.
Well, I mentioned a little earlier my disdain for Christopher Columbus. Is that a good word, disdain? Yeah, I guess so. I feel more disdain than ever, though. But anyway, you start with what you call the Columbus mythology. Let's talk about Columbus now.
Well, Columbus is, of course, a very pivotal figure in the history of America, because according to the white version, the Christian version, you know, that's when the history starts. And to get to an understanding of Columbus, we really have to do our best to separate the myth, you know, from what actually transpired. And some of these myths are that we're told Columbus was seeking a passage to India, and it was just kind of happy chance that he found, you know, the Caribbean. Well, in my research, I concluded that was a total fabrication, that Columbus knew exactly where he was going. He knew about it. He knew about America from both many, many Arab maps that he had. He and his brother Bartholomew had accumulated from the abandoned libraries of Toledo, Spain. So he had access to the maps, and by the way, these went into his personal collection, whereas you had manuscripts from these libraries make it out on mathematics and literature. The maps didn't make it out. So I'm pretty sure that Columbus had the Arab maps that was very specific with the trade winds and some of the passageways. But he also quite likely had Viking maps. His wife, Felipe, was intermarried with the Drummond Sinclair family, part of the very famous Henry Sinclair, who was Prince of Orkney Islands, and who reportedly traveled to America in the 1390s. So it's quite likely that from his wife, if not maps, he actually had stories. So in addition to that, he had the experience of sailing to know about the trade wind and the currents, and he knew about how long it would take. And so he didn't take with him jewels and gold that he was going to give to the great Khan if he was going to China or India. No, he took little beads with him. So also, you know, the whole story of him coming and planting a sword and claiming, the Americas for the king and queen, that would have been a bad move if you were dealing with the great Khan. So the whole mythology that, you know, it was happy chance and he made it here, just kind of by luck, nothing could be further from the truth. What is being disguised by this mythology is that Columbus was the one to first establish slavery in the Americas, and he instigated the genocide of Native Americans, along with the destruction of their culture and the confiscation of their lands. And you know, this is why we see the mythology of Columbus standing tall. That historians and the good people of the United States don't want to recognize the genocide of the conquest. And the professors and the intellectuals and the archaeo priesthood, the archaeologists really don't make the connection between the Columbus myth and preserving that myth by hiding evidence of earlier explorers, because if the whole Christian domination and the whole Christian culture that still dominates the United States would have its underpinning. So it's an incredible part of American history that we still even celebrate Columbus Day, and I'm glad to say that there are towns and states around the country that have done away with it and celebrate it, Indigenous Peoples Day, and an alternative holiday. So this is again what we need to have happen with a new paradigm and a new history of America is to debunk the Columbus myth.
Well, I was just so surprised that Samuel Eliot Morison took the views that he did on Columbus. Especially knowing that the brutality that Columbus toward the Caribs and others, basically saying it was more than justified. So I've decided I'm going to give away my two copies of history, Mr. Eliot. Why do I call him Eliot there? Because it's his middle name. Good old Sam's. I used to call him Sam, Uncle Sam. I was just so surprised, and I was so glad that you pointed out that these kind of things happen, which gives a very good view that the old paradigm, which Eliot Morison represents, certainly gave Columbus a good deal more credit than he deserved. That's my lowly opinion in this particular subject.
Well, the conquistadors, and it includes Cortez and Pizarro and Columbus, came out of a culture in Europe that was really quite corrupt, and they had developed the art of war to such a level with guns and gunpowder and steel and horses, that they had the absolute combination.
We got 1 minute
to take over the Americas, and they did in a very short matter of time with, of course, germs and diseases. But it was the ruthlessness that came out of the Dark Ages of Europe and the wars with the Muslims and just the treachery that went in with the church itself, that was unleashed on the Americas, and it decimated 90% of the Native American population within 50 years of Columbus arriving.
Our break is here, friends. Carl Lehrberger is our guest, Secrets of Ancient America, Archaeoastronomy and the Legacy of the Phoenicians, Celts, and Other Forgotten Explorers, Inner Traditions Publishing, newhistoryofamerica.com. You better check that one out, and we'll be quizzing you on that next week.
On the next 21st Century Radio, the Monroe Institute on their Lucid Dreaming Intensive Workshop and Paul H. Smith on how remote viewing is like martial arts for the brain. Sunday night at 8, 21st Century Radio, Talk Radio 680 WCBM.
This is Max Dashu of the Suppressed Histories Archives. You're listening to 21st Century Radio with Dr. Bob Hieronymus. For global women's heritages, icons, and video clips, visit www.suppresshistories.net.
Welcome back to 21st Century Radio. Our guest is Carl Lehrberger. The great book is, and it is a great book, Secrets of Ancient America. And right away, I'm going to say this to you. If you purchase a copy of this book and you can prove it, you can have any book that I've written or my wife has written, or we've got books that go back 28, 29 years of guests. So you can choose whatever you want. That's how important this book is. And that's why it should be in high schools and universities, because when especially I think people are going to find history far more interesting than they ever thought, especially with this particular work. Let's get to, in your book, you document many foreign travelers in Americas before Columbus. Who were they, and why did they come here?
Well, that's a great question. Who and why did they come here? I'll begin by saying that from the point of view of history, Columbus was last, not first, and that's one of the themes of the book. The focus of my research, and I'd say five chapters out of the book, were devoted to the Celts. And I focused on the Celts because I found the evidence to be so good that it, to me, was proof that long before Columbus, European travelers had made it here. And the smoking gun evidence was not just in one location or not just in one site, but really stretched across half of North America. And we can go back and suspect that the earliest Celts made it here thousands of years ago across the Atlantic as copper miners, and along with Phoenicians before them, the very rich sources of copper in the Great Lake regions was a source of commerce for many foreign cultures, including the Hebrews, the Phoenicians, and the Celts. So we suspect that they arrived in the Americas looking for copper and other minerals. And they set up a base, the Celts set up a base in New England. And we could even go so far as to say it should have been named New Ireland, because the Celts really had a stronghold. You can still see some of the architectural works of the Celtic America at a place called Stonehenge, America's Stonehenge, outside of Salem, New Hampshire. And not only did they have their structures there, but they have writing. And throughout New England, we see evidence of the monuments and the dwellings of the Celtic peoples going back at least 2,000 years ago. Following the river systems to the Mississippi, they found their way into Colorado, Oklahoma, and Kansas, where I devote four chapters to very specific sites, looking at the petroglyphs they left and the actual Celtic writing that are left in the walls, and not just one word here or, you know, two words here and a phrase here, but you know, significant writing, most of it addressing the calendrics, the equinoxes, and the gatherings and rituals that take place, you know, with these very sacred days of the Celts. So I felt it was important to make the case, the best case that I could, to undermine the Columbus mythology. And certainly the Celts are the smoking gun, in my opinion. However, it wasn't just the Celts. We find evidence that the Romans made it to the Americas, not just North America, Central America, but also South America. And Romans shipped off Central and South America runes of them in the harbors and off the coast have been found that with large vases with their commerce inside. So we have evidence that the Romans were there. We also have coins, and in the case of a community called Calalis in Arizona, outside of Tucson, that has been, they never discovered the community Calalis, but they found the artifacts from it, a Roman colony around the time of 600 AD. And we have writing and artifacts from a Roman culture that made it into Arizona. There's been many researchers that have looked at the Chinese and Asian influences in the Americas. I highlight Thompson's work on that he looks at the various symbols of the Mayans and Asian symbols, and clearly determines that many of the Mayan symbols came from Asia and China, mm-hmm. and he just makes a very compelling case in American Discovery. And for that, Gunnar Thompson was really put through the ringer in terms of being denied publishing his works. He was never given tenure, even though he's a PhD, and he's really one of the foremost diffusionist scholars that is still alive. And he has documented, along with other people, the Chinese. We most recently have a new book by John Ruskamp called Asiatic Echoes that also talks about Chinese influences in America. We see Mediterranean and North African people, including the Phoenicians, and we know they were here because they left their writing in stone. One of the examples cited in Secrets of Ancient America and well known is the Bourne Stone from Massachusetts that can still be seen in a museum with Phoenician writing on it. We also have Middle Eastern evidence from Middle Eastern cultures from Ecuador in the Crespi collection.
A
collector and priest named Carlo Crespi was able to acquire from the natives an amazing amount of artifacts, some of which were indicative of foreign travelers, including the Sumerians. And these were gold tablets, and we only have photographs of them. But we really can suggest that based on the written historical record in these photographs that the gold tablets were real. I spent a couple chapters in the book talking about Indus Valley and Indo-Turkey visitors from the Armenian highlands and greater Indus Valley cultures. I suggest resulted in a diffusion of some of these Indus Valley cultures into the Great Basin. And one particular site in the that I note in the book called Mojave North, I don't give the location, indicates that some of the most profound, really esoteric wisdom from the Indus Valley cultures are preserved in the Great Basin in Eastern California.
Oh my!
So these sites go back very, very far, 3,000 or 4,000 years, and the evidence is almost impossible to see except with great light conditions. So what is clear from the evidence, and it's not just evidence that we can't say is 100% sure, such as these artifacts that you know, can be moved or can be faked. But the 100% evidence that that in the writing and the petroglyphs of these travelers, as well as some of the artifacts, that Columbus was the last of a long tradition of explorers in the Americas, going back many thousands of years, including Romans, Hebrews, Phoenicians, and Asiatic people.
Let's take a look a little bit closer at you mentioned Hebrews just a second ago. There have been claims of Hebrews in America, and I want to ask you what you found, but one of the things that really surprised me some 30-some years ago was the Bat Creek, Tennessee piece. But tell us, what did you find about the Hebrews coming to America?
Well, I found the evidence scant, but significant. And it goes beyond the, you know, a number of Hebrew coins found in the Carolinas. It goes beyond the famous Bat Creek stone that was purportedly dug out of one of the mounds by a Smithsonian researcher, archaeologist. And it's a stone a little bigger than the size of a fist or a big cell phone, and it's got five characters written on it. And the Smithsonian originally thought they were Cherokee, but several diffusionist scholars noted that the piece was upside down and was actually a Semitic script.
Mm-hmm.
Most people who point to the Hebrews in America, you know, the Bat Creek stone is the smoking gun, one of them. But it really points out how any kind of an artifact is hard pressed to be a smoking gun unless it's fixed, such as the Kensington runestone, which was done by Vikings in the 1300s, I believe, mm-hmm. in Minnesota, and it was a huge, you know, multi-ton stone, and no one's going to be, you know, faking that and bringing it in and out like you can with an artifact. Nevertheless, the Semitic writing on the Bat Creek stone is indicative of Hebrew influences, but I wouldn't call it a smoking gun as many people have. Mm-hmm. I did find some what I thought were smoking guns with the Los Lunas petroglyph site in New Mexico, where they have at this particular site the Ten Commandments in pre-block Hebrew written on a monumental stone. And there's just enough mistakes in it, in the stone carving, to give it credibility, in my opinion. And at this particular site, which is called Las Lunas, south of Albuquerque, it's not just the Ten Commandments stone, but there's other Hebrew, or early pre-Hebrew writing at the site, that is indicative that the Hebrews, you know, did make it to America and actually had a settlement. South of there, and a site that I have already mentioned in this interview, Calais, near Tucson, Arizona, and a little later than the Los Lunas site, a Roman colony made up of Hebrews had a 300-year history that was recorded in artifacts and lead crosses, and it's such a phenomenal story, the story of Calais, because while most of the writing on these pretty large and heavy metal crosses made out of lead are in Latin, you also find drawings on the artifacts with Hebrew inscriptions and Hebrew numbering. So that we think that Calais was actually a colony by dissident Hebrews from the Roman Empire, and made it to Arizona, and had, I don't want to say thriving, but a ongoing colony that fought with the local natives from 600 A.D. to right around 900 A.D. when the sage who was recording this OG writes that they are about to be overtaken by the Indians, and that he hopes that the his account of the colony of Calais was true and will survive. So we find the not only the later day post-Christian Hebrew influences, but it's likely that the early earliest Hebrews also made it to America along with those Phoenicians and Phoenician routes. But the older we go back in time, the harder it is to reconstruct, and that's why rock art and petroglyphs really are some of the best evidence we have. And when we do have inscriptions like we do of the Celts in Oklahoma and Colorado, or the Phoenicians off the coast of Maine, and in the case of the Bat Creek Stone, pre-Semitic or pre-Hebrew writing, as we find in Colorado and in the Four Corners area, it's very substantial evidence. You're not taking a coin in and throwing it down and saying it's a Roman coin, like the archaeopriests suspect has happened. You have these fixed monumental artifacts, and this is really one of the big complaints of diffusionist scholars, that it's claimed there aren't any artifacts, but the truth is there are a significant body of artifacts proving that old world cultures from both the Atlantic and the trans-Pacific cultures made it to the Americas. So we have some of those Hebrew artifacts, and we also have monumental writing of the Hebrews in Arizona. One of the most compelling cases for the presence of Hebrews before Columbus is not artifacts at all, but it is some of the traditions of specific Native American tribes that seem to have been influenced by the Hebrew culture. And there's a Native tribe called the Yachis, for example, that celebrates the Hebrew holiday Sukkot, and it's where they build a structure. It's a harvest festival, and it lasts for 8 days, and it's very specific to the holiday of Sukkot. But the Yuchis celebrate this almost identically, and you also have other ritualistic artifacts that have been preserved by some of these Native American cultures.
And with that, we need to take our final break of the hour, and we will return with our guest Carl Lehrberger, Secrets of Ancient America, Archaeoastronomy, and the Legacy of Phoenicians, Celts, and Other Forgotten Explorers. Boy, knowing that there were over 500 coins have been found on the east-west coasts of America and in Michigan, that's quite a few coins from somewhere, huh? Maybe they just had minted them here in America, of course. We'll be back with our guest in just a few minutes.
Talk and breaking news on Talk Radio 680 WCBM Baltimore and WCBM.com.
Fox News Radio, I'm Paul Stevens.